Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here. ArchiCAD is the official BIM software of the Entree Architect community. ArchiCAD BIM software enables design, collaboration, visualization, and project delivery no matter the project size or complexity. With flexible licensing options and a dedicated support team to guide us along the way, ArchiCAD is an ideal choice for firms and projects of any size. I encourage you to reach out and talk to the folks at Graphisoft by visiting our own dedicated webpage at graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect. There's even an exclusive special offer waiting for our Entree Architect community. Go now to graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. That's graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect. My name is Mark Arlepage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Hosea Kanani, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
It's great to have you here. Hosea Kanani is the founder of Studio 4, an architecture and interiors firm based in New York City with global projects ranging from workplace to community-centered projects. She received her MArch from the University of California, Berkeley, and her previous career as a sociologist in public health continues to have a strong influence on how she approaches design. She's a founding member and currently co-chair of the AIA New York Social Science and Architecture Committee, as well as a co-founder and board vice president of Design Advocates, a nonprofit organization established in March 2020 for architects to share resources and collaborate on efforts to serve the public good through pro bono projects, research, and advocacy. She is a core organizer for the Design as Protest Collective, a group of anti-racist designers dedicated to design justice in the built environment. Hosea, welcome, and thanks for joining me.
Thanks again.
Let's start off with your story. That's where I like to start with every episode, because I want to learn a lot about you, where you came from, what inspired you to become an architect, and share maybe who or what inspired you, and offer that story to where we find ourselves today.
Sure. This is a story that I love to tell, actually.
Great.
Because I think so much of being an architect comes from your general life experience and your own history. And so mine sort of starts with my parents, who were refugees from the country of Uganda in East Africa in the early 1970s. And some people may know the history, but others may not. So there was a military coup of the government, and the head of the military took over, who was a man named Idi Amin, who was ended up being a pretty harsh dictator. My family is of Indian, Southeast Asian Indian descent. And so all of the Indians that lived in Uganda were given 3 days to leave the country or they would be jailed. And so my family had been in Africa for probably two or three generations at that point. And so everyone just sort of had to pack a suitcase and, you know, the British came in and sort of had flights ready for people to leave. And so families and people ended up either being going to Britain, or they went to Europe, or some went to Australia. And so my family went to the UK. And a few months after, my dad and one of his cousins traveled to Canada and sort of said, hey, there's like jobs here. There was a refugee program. And so brought over, you know, my mother and my sister and my aunts and uncles and my grandparents who are still alive. And they all kind of settled in Ontario. And then I was born there after they settled in. And, you know, they had sort of factory jobs and for a number of months. And then my father was trained as a textile engineer, and he somehow got an opportunity in the U.S. And so my immediate family moved to Vermont, which I will say, for my parents, winter was something they never knew in their whole lives. And so to see snow for the first time, I remember hearing the stories about it.
And not just snow, Vermont snow.
Like Canada snow and then Vermont snow.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
And so then I think when I was about three, we moved to New Hampshire. So sort of going south slowly. And I had another sibling born there. And then we moved to North Carolina, which was much more their climate, I will say, hot and humid. And so I spent most of my childhood in North Carolina, and had a fourth sibling that was born there. My parents
Where in North Carolina?
In Durham, North Carolina. And because North Carolina is, or it was, a major hub for textiles, that's kind of what drew my parents down there, and my dad especially for his work. So you know, they settled there, they built their first house. You know, they raised a family, but through all of that, they were very adamant about trying to retain their culture and their religion, and especially with us. And, you know, I think it's interesting for immigrants because there is some level of wanting to assimilate, but there's another part of that where you want to retain, like, your heritage. Right. And so I think that's a balance that a lot of I think immigrants to this country are trying to figure out. And so part of that retaining heritage was us traveling. And any vacation we had, whether it was a 3-day weekend or my parents taking us out of school, we were going to see our family. And so on a 3-day weekend, we would drive, we would do a 16-hour drive to Canada so my parents could see their siblings and we could see our cousins, because they were so used to growing up with those people. And similarly, they would take us out of school for months and we would go to India or we would go to Africa and see our families. And part of those trips was seeing architecture for me, and sort of understanding the history of my culture or other cultures. You know, we traveled a lot. And that was one thing. My parents, you know, were very frugal with money, but there was one thing they would spend it on, and it was travel. And so growing up, I saw, you know, more parts of the world by the time I was in middle school than most people in North Carolina see in their whole lives. And and the architecture was a huge part of that for me, and sort of At an early age, I had an interest in sort of like archaeology. Of course, Indiana Jones was like a big thing during my childhood. And so it was like archaeology and architecture and history, and seeing these ruins around the world was really what founded my love of architecture. And seeing my parents build their own house, and yeah. I was like 6 or 7 years old, and seeing that whole process and going to the construction site was pretty fascinating.
Did your parents sort of guide you to architecture, or did it just be sort of the interest sort of grow naturally from your experiences?
It was definitely my own interest. As some people may know and some people may not know, but for immigrants, they want their children to be doctors, lawyers, right. accountants.
Architects are not on the list.
Yeah, architects are not on the list. And so, yeah, it was sort of something I just sort of developed. And I think what's interesting is my dad is an engineer, or was an engineer. My mother is very creative. She was a seamstress, and then she became an interior decorator like later in life. And so it's like this weird crossover between their skill sets and and architecture was kind of that perfect mix.
Do you remember the moment where you realized there was a profession of architecture and this is something you could do?
I do. And this is like very cliche, and I've actually seen it in a movie. But it was when I was in high school. I was 15 and we went to India to see my grandparents. And that was the trip we went to see the Taj Mahal.
That would do it.
And it wasn't even the actual Taj Mahal. It was actually the buildings that were surrounding it, which no one really knows about.
Right.
There's like multiple buildings that were constructed as part of this compound. And it was there where I said to my parents, like, I think I want to be an architect. And, they sort of ignored me because they thought that I should be a doctor. But
hopefully they've come around.
Yeah. Took a little while, but yeah.
So you went through California, University of California. How'd you pick University of California, Berkeley?
So I actually did my undergrad. I went to UNC Chapel Hill, which was a state school for me, and they didn't have architecture. So I studied sociology and public health, and I had a whole career in that. And then when I was about 26, I decided I wanted to go back to school, and I thought, I'll either sort of get a degree, I'll get the MD, or I'll get an MPH, which is a master's in public health, or maybe actually I'll get an MArch and like really try this, because I realized there were 3-year programs for people who didn't have architecture backgrounds. And what I came to also realize from my work in public health is that there is a direct correlation between quality of life and public health and housing. And so I sort of thought, oh, like I have this base in public health. Architecture could actually be the tool to improve the quality of lives for others, versus going to become a doctor and going to work in third world countries or getting an MPH and trying to work on policy changes. And so that's really like how I came back to architecture. And so I ended up going to Parsons School of Design in New York for a year. At that prior, I was living in DC working for the NIH, and I went to do the pre-architecture program just to make sure that I was making the right decision. And they help you put a portfolio together, because of course I didn't have one. And then I applied, to a number of schools. And when I had gone to visit schools, Berkeley had been on my top choice because they were the only program at the time that had a concentration in social and cultural factors in design. And I was sort of like, okay, this is it. This is the culmination of how all of these pieces come together. So that's how I came to Berkeley.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you had the career in sociology, went back to this passion for architecture, and now have brought these things together with your interest in people and housing and health and all of that. It's a perfect example of the flexibility of what architecture can be. I love that idea about architecture, is that architecture can be anything we want it to be. And so how does that manifest for you and your firm?
I think it manifests in a couple different ways. The first one is that it's really about the people, and that is our main focus, like the human side of design, and the people who we're collaborating with, whether it's clients or our contractors or consultants, or even just in our office. Like we're very focused on the human side of things, and that design for me, architecture is a tool. It's not actually the focus. It's like a means to an end, actually.
Yeah. Explain that. Go deeper on that. What does that mean?
So that, in I guess the way that I would think of it is, for us, the most important thing is that the spaces ultimately improve the quality of life for the users and the stakeholders. And if a project doesn't do that, it's not successful for us. And it could look like anything. That's sort of the other part of it is I know a lot of architects and architecture firms sort of have signature styles. And for us, because every single client we have is different in some way, the design is ultimately always different. And I've had people ask me that, you know, like, what's your firm's signature style?
Right.
And I sort of say that doesn't exist in our office, because every project is different.
Right. You're designing to the people.
Yeah. So I think that's sort of the first part, is the focus is really different. I think the outcomes are different also. And then the process of how we get to design is really different, which for me is based in my education in sociology and work in public health, where it's all research and data driven.
Interesting. So how do you do that? How do you do the research and the data part?
I literally took the methods that we used in those other fields and applied them to architecture, which now is becoming more common. I think, especially as we talk about stakeholder engagement, which is kind of a buzzword right now, especially in community-based projects. But, you know, we have a whole slew of questionnaires that we use, you know, whether they're surveys. We do focus groups with all of our clients. We do interviews. We do one-on-ones with them. We actually go observe them in their existing spaces. And not even talking to them, just like really watching them for the whole day and seeing how they're using their space to understand, you know, what's working in those spaces for them, what's not working, what's happening in the space that they can't articulate to us, but just is sort of innate behavior. So for us, it's a really in-depth approach to a project, I guess, of what you call pre-design research. Yeah, and then we put all of that data together into graphics and visuals for our clients and kind of present that back to them. And, you know, I think usually they're sort of like, oh, it's great to kind of see this on paper and how this turns into data. But there are always some surprises too.
What kind of work do you do?
So our projects range basically between three areas. We do corporate workplace, which are office projects, and we do that globally. That's what kind of takes us around the world. We do residential projects, which is mostly custom residential, both in New York City, and also we do ground up work outside of the city and around the country. And then we do community-based work as well. So it's usually projects for nonprofits, you know, where their community centers or community-driven work.
You said you work all over the world. So how did that happen? I mean, it's you focused a firm based on designing for humans, designing for people. It primarily has focused itself around office space, residential, and community work. How did it go from locally in New York City to a global practice?
So this is actually another one of my favorite stories, which is we have a global client that is solely for workplace projects. And the name of their company is MSCI, and they're sort of the research side of financial advising for clients. And they also establish some of the funds that maybe your 401k program is made up of, and they have a pretty big push for sustainability and environmental kind of funds around the world. So their mission is while very corporate, is actually really conscious as well in terms of ESG ideas. And so they were looking for someone to come in and kind of help them redesign one of their cafes in their New York headquarter office. And their contractor said, "Oh, we've worked with this young new architect. You should really, you know, maybe meet with her. Maybe she can help you with some small aspect of your office." And so I went to their office and you know, helped them with the kitchen. And then I said, "You know, your office, while it's great, like, it's not really representative of who you are and the work that you're doing, because I just assumed you were another fintech company, and actually you're not. You do really socially conscious work, and that is not reflected in this space." And they took that, the head of corporate services that I spoke to, you know, I said, "I hope I'm not being too forward or too rude, but it could be better." And they took it back to the head of HR, the global head of HR. And so I ended up having this interview, and they said, "We're looking for a new global architect, and we wanted to talk to you. And we're interviewing two other global firms, one who we've worked with for 10 years and another new one. And so you have, you know, this opportunity." And those two teams came in with like 10 people for their interview, and mine was just me. And this was back in 2017. And then they actually hired me and said, "Let's try this. Why don't you do our first, you know, new office project that's happening in Hong Kong this year? And let's see how it's a pretty small project. Let's see how it goes." And so since then, we've been the global architect for them. We've worked on probably 15 offices now. We've got 7 projects in progress right now. That are going to be done by Q2 in 2023. So that's how the global work came about.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, right? But trying to figure out our financials on our own is not one of those things. Luckily, we have FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for business owners like us. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices, to managing online payments, to organizing expenses, and automates them with features like the digital bills and receipt scanner, saving you up to 11 hours a week in the process. It's also super easy to get up and running, and the award-winning FreshBooks support team, they are always available to answer any questions along the way. Compare that to some of the other financial management tools out there. Try FreshBooks for free for 30 days, no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/architect to get started today. That's freshbooks.com/architect. So what will you do with 11 more hours each week? This episode is brought to you by Arcat.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by ArtCat. Listen and subscribe right now at ArtCat.com/podcast. That's ArtCat.com/podcast. ArtCat.com/podcast. Detailed. Every building has a story. This episode is brought to you by the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting, the business conference for small firm entrepreneur architects. Learn more at smallfirmconference.com. If you could build a business conference for small firm entrepreneur architects, what would it be? Since I launched Entree Architect back in 2012, I've been listening. I've been watching what members want and learning what we need. And in November, we will gather in Austin, Texas, to connect, to celebrate, to honor, and to learn. The Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting was inspired, designed, and launched for you. We invited top speakers to share fast-paced, get-to-the-point TED Talk-like presentations that will provide you with the information that you need so that you can build the firm that you want. On day one of the conference, following a lineup of fantastic speakers, we'll discover the connection between mental health and our financial wealth with licensed clinical professional counselor, Joyce Martyr. And then we'll be honoring three architect members of the community at the inaugural Entree Architect Honor Awards. On day two, we'll hear from more great speakers, then dive deep into the successful future of our firms with Brian McCartney of ArcMark at a 90-minute strategic planning program. We'll have some fun building models with Kenya and Matt Forget of Sticks and Bricks, and we'll learn from an icon, Gene Cohn, founder of KPF, at the Day 2 keynote. We planned this event to start with an evening reception on Tuesday, November 1st, and end on Thursday afternoon on November 3rd, so that you'll have time to connect with friends post-event to discover the city of Austin and its amazing architectural sites on Friday and into the weekend. We've been approved by the AIA for 12.75 CEUs, and everyone will leave with a cool bag of swag. Whether you're a member of the Entree Architect Community Facebook group, a member of the Entree Architect Academy membership, or a small firm architect practicing anywhere in the world who wants and needs the support and connection of like-minded architects, the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting Small Firm Business Conference is for you. With generous support from our friends at Monograph, visit smallfirmconference.com now for tickets, and we will see you in Austin this November. That's smallfirmconference.com. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
So you were up against two global firms, established global firms. One worked for the company for 10 years. They come in with a full team, which probably also had marketing backup, right? Full marketing proposal. You show up, you probably spent the night putting together your proposal, presented it, and you won. So my question is, how did you win? What do you think about what you presented to them had them choose you over the firms that they've been working with and had the backup?
I honestly think it was the way that I talked about the people. I talked very little about design, actually.
Yeah.
In that discussion, and I didn't show them any designs or anything like that. You know, we talked about the impact of design on people, and what the positive effects space and design could have on them. And you know, it was an hour long discussion. I had a few slides, but not that many. And it was a conversation, and it was something that I feel very strongly about. So it was easy to kind of convince them. And someone who's the head of global HR, like, it's all about people for them as well. And so there was this kind of this alignment and values that was just immediately present.
Yeah,
Yeah, I like asking that question because there's people listening who may be in that position, right? And have to go up against these big firms, and just being real and just connecting human to human makes a big difference.
And I mean, just to be really frank about it, I mean, I felt I had no chance. Like, I am at that point, there were two people in my firm. I am a woman of color. These firms are like large global firms with, like, no offense, Mark, but what, white men at the helm, and like, you know, they're establishments. And so I just sort of thought, oh, maybe I'll just keep helping them with the cafe, and that's sort of it. But I think they were sort of open to seeing what somebody else who was different could do.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's a fantastic story. So your work with human behavior and understanding how human behavior is affected by architecture has also grown beyond your architecture firm. You're the co-founder and board vice president of Design Advocates. What's Design Advocates and what do you do there?
So, again, this is super relevant to people who are sole practitioners or who run small firms. But, you know, in March 2020, everyone who owned a small firm or was a sole practitioner thought their architecture careers were over. And, you know, work just came to a screeching halt. The whole world came to a halt, right? And so, you know, by the time April rolled around, we didn't have very much work at all. And we were working on office standards and sort of trying to keep the team busy. And a friend of a friend of mine who also owns a small firm in New York City texted me and said, hey, there's this call that's happening once a week for small firm owners. There's like a group of 10 of us. You know, I think maybe it would be great for you to come. And he said, oh, and I said, yeah, that would be great. And he said, have you applied for a PPP loan? And I said, yes, I did actually this week. Like, our financial advisors helped us do that. And we actually got it like within a week. And he said, that's amazing. Everyone's been trying to do this and no one's been successful yet. So you should definitely come to the call so you can help us.
Yeah.
And so I went to this call and I met, you know, this whole cohort of people who own small firms. And it was really like a therapy session for us because we were all freaking out about what was going to happen. And everyone was trying to apply for a PPP loan. So we all sort of helped each other, which is also something that in my experience I had not seen in the world of architecture was the sense of community amongst practitioners did not exist because the field and sort of the industry and the way it's set up is based on competition, right? And winning projects. And to me, that was so foreign coming from a place of public health where it's all about community. And right. I never understood that. And so like through my architecture career, I've never had any issue when somebody's asked me, hey, how did you figure out the fees for this project? Or like, what do you pay your employees? Like, I always am open to sharing that. And I was shocked that other people weren't. And when I got on this call, it was the first time in my, you know, 11 years of owning a firm where people were open and were like, let me help you do this. Or what do you, you know, how did you do this? And the sharing of knowledge was really this glimmer of hope amongst everything that was happening in the world that was really terrible. And so after a few weeks, you know, there were six of us on the call who were firm owners, and we were sort of brainstorming like, well, I was sort of saying, God, I should have been the doctor my parents told me. I could be in the ER right now helping COVID patients was the first thought. And then I was like, no. That's not the right answer.
That's not going to help now.
Yeah. And so we started brainstorming, like, how could we actually with design skills help because there are clearly a whole slew of issues that are going to come up in the next few weeks that have to do with space design because of COVID.
Right.
And so we started making kind of cold calls to our clients or nonprofits we knew or people who were really active and in underserved neighborhoods in New York and sort of said, like, how can we help, you know, in places where they can't afford design and it's impacting, you know, either their businesses, which is their livelihood for most of these people, or it's affecting their ability to provide social services to a greater community. And even education, right? Like schools, that was a huge thing. And so we started, you know, just getting cold calls about like, hey, like I have a small restaurant. Like, do you think you could help me with open streets or open restaurant kind of planning? And, you know, we ended up forming this nonprofit called Design Advocates, which, you know, the baseline premise was to provide pro bono services to help people survive through the pandemic. So that's kind of the story there.
So what's the future of Design Advocates as the pandemic is coming to an end, hopefully? What is the vision for Design Advocates?
Yeah, so it quickly expanded beyond what we expected because everybody wanted to help. And, you know, by the end of the first month, we had 50 volunteers. By the end of 2020, we had 200 volunteers. And so what we decided to do was to create like a couple of different arms within Design Advocates. So there is the design services kind of section, which, you know, the projects are still going. You know, we generally are helping people who can't afford design services, but would benefit from it, or it would improve the work that they're doing. And, you know, it ranges anywhere from like community theaters to places of worship to transitional housing for women with children in the Bronx. And then we sort of have our advocacy arm. And so we're trying to make change within public policy that has to do with the built environment in the city. So, you know, we have groups that are focusing on open streets, which is a big topic in New York City right now. And as well as sort of tapping into education at an early age and sort of helping young people understand that architecture and design can be a career path for them, even though they've never been exposed to it, and understanding that if they go down this path, they actually have a say in what happens in their neighborhood and to their own community. So that's kind of been another interesting arm that's developed. We have people who are teaching courses as part of Design Advocates at local institutions here in the city. So it's still evolving. And, you know, we're in the process of trying to figure out finances and how do we sustain this. But I think the bottom line is that most of us became architects because we wanted to make a difference and right. We wanted to make change. And that's what keeps people coming back, I think, to Design Advocates.
So if you want to learn more about Design Advocates, it's designadvocates.org. Can go check out what they're doing there. I'm assuming people, if they want to volunteer and help out and get involved, they can do that there as well?
Yes, for sure. We have a link on the page where you can sign up. Or if you have a project or a client who needs someone you know that needs pro bono design services, they can also, there's a link for that. They can fill out information as well.
Is it local to New York City or is it national, global?
It is not local to New York City. Most of the work is in New York City, but we've done work in California. We've done work in Michigan.
Okay. So anybody who's interested should check it out. The other thing that in my introduction of you're also the core organizer for the Design as Protest Collective. What's that?
So it's another group of amazing architects, designers, planners, landscape architects, graphic designers, people in fashion who really are trying to dismantle and change the existence of systemic racism within the built mm-hmm. environment, and the way it's practiced, the way that it's taught, and the way it manifests in spaces.
So how do they do that? Is that through speaking, presenting, protesting? How does that happen?
Yeah, I think it happens through all of those things. You know, there are people who teach who are trying to change the curriculum of architecture, even as high as sort of, you know, NCARB and what we're required to complete to become an architect in terms of education, experience, and even exams.
Yeah.
And sort of challenging some of those systems to say that they're not equitable. And then, as I said, coursework, we're trying to change like what actual students are taught in architecture programs, right? It's been very much about a specific history or
sure.
specific
yeah.
people and specific types of architecture. And so like, how do we expand that to be more inclusive and equitable yeah. and diverse? And then there are like, you know, really like physical and direct actions that we're taking, like doing installations. And we have one project called Tactical Protest, where we've created these a package of signage that you can take to protests that are talk about the inequities in the built environment and in policy. And we printed them in like 10 different languages. And so, you know, the messaging is there. And then one other specific project that I'm working on with a group within design as protest is healing hostile architecture. And so we applied through an RFP that was hosted by the Design Trust for Public Space. And they were really looking for projects, project proposals that were going to look at the impact of the built environment on public health. So, of course, for me, that was kind
there
of
you
like,
go.
I've yeah. been waiting for this. And so one of the things that we really think about in design as protest is how public space, one, is inequitable, and two, the effects that it has on people who are experiencing it. And so this project is really focused on hostile architecture, what it is, the existence of it, how it manifests in public space, and then the impacts that it has on the houseless community. And so we're going to be embarking on a research project, kind of looking at the history and sort of the policy that has supported hostile architecture, and then ultimately looking at how we can change that, and what do new models of public space look like that are supportive yeah. and healing?
Right. What's the alternative? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. So if you're interested in learning more about design as protest, it's a DAP as in design as protest, dapcollective.org. We'll have links to all of that on the show notes. The one final question that I ask everybody, Fauzia, is what is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
When you say build today for a better tomorrow, the word that comes to mind is investment. For me,
mm-hmm.
And I think most people would agree that the field of architecture needs to change. It's shifting, but it needs to shift faster. And so, you know, I would say to small firm owners, you know, get involved in your community. Look to see how you can be supportive of people in your community through design, and think about really who you're mentoring, right? I mean,
yeah.
one of the beauties of having a small firm is that you have a lot of day-to-day interaction with the people you engage with, whether it's in the community or whether it's people you're collaborating with or people within your firm. And so, you know, think about where you're hiring from and who you're hiring from, and especially if you're going to schools you know, in New York City, we have Columbia, right, for architecture, but we also have City Tech, which is a technical school, which is the lowest funded New York state school that's part of the system. And so, you know, I'm sure that there are eager students there that are looking for a career in architecture that could use your experience and your knowledge for them to find a path down this road of architecture.
Yeah. What a fascinating story you have to hear where your family came from, how you got to New York City, the work that you do, the impact that you're making. It's inspirational, and I appreciate you for doing the work that you do. It's been a pleasure talking with you here.
Thank you so much for having me and for listening and being interested. It means a lot.
Her name is Fauzia Kanani. If you want to go check out her firm, it's studio4ny.com. So F-O-R, New York, 4 New York, studio4ny.com. That was confusing. Studio4ny.com. That's more clear. The links will all be on the show notes. Fauzia, thank you for dedicating yourself to architecture and making that change, because you're making a massive impact on people every day in the work that you're doing, the global work that you're doing. It's inspirational to hear not only your story, but the work that you're doing and how architects have an influence in the way the world works, right? Not only through the built environment, but with, like you said, with the interaction that we have with other people, whether they're clients or the people that are working and living within our architecture, you're doing that and you're demonstrating that and you're a role model. So I appreciate you for the work that you do. And I appreciate you coming by here at the Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so much again, Mark.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. That's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. Share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Links to our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network, the network dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. And visit smallfirmconference.com for more information about our lineup of speakers, check out the agenda, and purchase your tickets for the Entree Architect Community Annual Meeting, the business conference for small firm entrepreneur architects. We do have a few tickets still available, but we're almost sold out. So visit smallfirmconference.com and register today. And before we wrap up, a special thank you to our partners at Graphisoft for helping our community of architects make the transition to BIM with ArchiCAD software. Go now to graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. Visit graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect to learn more. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark Arla Page. Love, learn, and share what you know. Hey, before we sign off, I wanted to share something with you, an update, some bonus content for you. I wanted to share my progress with learning to BIM. You know, you've probably heard that Entree Architect and Graphisoft has partnered up. The Entree Architect community now has partnered up with Graphisoft and ArchiCAD. I wanted to share some background, how we got to this relationship and why I'm choosing ArchiCAD as my tool. This is not an ad. This is just an update on my journey to learning to BIM. I've been practicing architecture since graduating architecture school in 1993. That's a long time ago. And I've been running my own architecture firm since 1999. And since I've started, I've been using AutoCAD. I've been using AutoCAD as my primary software to design and develop our projects. And now, I've just done the math, it's almost 30 years into this with me. I'm 52 years old, and after several false starts of trying to transition, today's the day. Well, this week is the week. I'm finally committing to learning to BIM. And I know, learning to BIM. I love that phrase. I know BIM is not a verb. I just love the way that sounds. For me, I know that I'm not only learning software, I'm learning a new practice. I'm learning a new method. I'm learning a new process. So for me, I'm learning to BIM. So that's why I keep saying that. So if you have been listening here for the past couple of weeks, I've announced a new partnership with Graphisoft. Graphisoft is now the official partner of Entree Architect and the Entree Architect community. And as the founder of Entree Architect, a community of tens of thousands of entrepreneur architect business owners, when I personally decided to finally make the commitment and learn to BIM, I looked at which software I wanted to use. And this wasn't very difficult, seeing that I've been researching and I've been learning and I've been studying, right? I've been procrastinating. Okay, that's what it's called. I've been procrastinating, but I've been researching and learning and studying all my options for decades, right? We all know what we need. I knew I needed to transition from CAD to BIM for more than a decade. But the fear of learning a new process, running a business, running an architecture firm, the excuse of not having the time, right? The overwhelm of which software to use, it all kept me from progressing. Fear kept me from choosing, from learning and from executing. And I'm quite certain that this constant procrastination and not choosing to grow has caused me thousands of hours. It cost me thousands of hours unnecessarily drafting and has cost me thousands, probably 10,000, maybe even hundreds of thousands of dollars in time spent in AutoCAD throughout all this time, right? All these decades. AutoCAD has been a great tool. Don't get me wrong. AutoCAD has been fantastic. I mastered AutoCAD and it has done what it's needed to do, but it doesn't do what BIM does, and it's time to make that transition. So I made the commitment and I committed to ARCHICAD. And what I've learned in all that time of researching and learning and executing and procrastinating, what I've learned is that ARCHICAD has many of the same tools and processes that I already know from using CAD. It's great. It's a great transition tool, right? Going from CAD to BIM, ARCHICAD is a great option for that. It has all the advantages of a full BIM package, but it also is intuitive to CAD users. And over a decade ago, this is probably even more important, I left my PCs in the past, right? I am not a Windows guy. I'm not a PCs guy. I'm a fully established Apple user, right? Apple products, and I run a top-of-the-line Mac Studio. I love my Macs, right? So I will never return to that world of Windows and PCs, ever. So Revit is out for me from the beginning. Before we even start the conversation, I want software that is native to my Mac. Revit has been promising that for years, and they haven't delivered. ARCHICAD was built for Mac, and it's always run native on the Mac OS. And for those of you who are still running PCs, ARCHICAD works native for you too. So no matter what machine you're using, ARCHICAD works, whether it's a Mac or a PC, good to go. Then so it came down to one other thing. It came down to the people behind the product. That's important to me. Who are the people behind the product? Which software will support me and you, right? My community. Because as with everything I do here at Entree Architect, this isn't only about me. I know that there are thousands of architects listening right now, you maybe, who are just like me, running CAD every day, knowing that you want to move to BIM. So I started talking to the people at ARCHICAD. I connected with Mark, and I connected with Alex and Mary and Zoltan and all the people, the team behind ARCHICAD. Not just the software and the company and all the things that it does, I wanted to talk to the people. We met several times for months preparing for this partnership that we have now, and I can confidently say that our friends at Graphisoft, they are committed to supporting you and me as people, as individuals, and all our small firms and our transition from CAD to BIM. Okay? They're there for us. So here we go. That's the background. Here's the update. This is what I've done to get started. This week, I've done four things to move my progress forward. Okay? Step one, here's what I did. Step one, I installed ArchiCAD on my Mac. And this is a process. This is not a quick thing. This is something that takes some time, but it's straightforward and simple. So it's done. ArchiCAD is now on my Mac, and I'm ready to roll. Step two, I gained access to the ArchiCAD Essentials package. This is important. The ArchiCAD Essentials package is an $800 training program that Graphisoft is providing to you and me, to our community, for free. When you purchase a subscription to ArchiCAD through our dedicated webpage, you will be automatically you'll automatically gain access to that training, the Essentials package. And this one was really important to me because I didn't want just the software. I wanted training. I can't learn to BIM if I don't have training. And so I negotiated with them and said, hey, we need something more than just the software. We need some training. And so they put together an option to access. This is a training program that they already have. It's $800. It's free to us when you purchase ArchiCAD. So you can check that out at graphisoft.com/us/entrearchitect. Again, this is not an advertisement. This is an update. I'm just telling you what I'm doing here. You can learn about the opportunity and access to that software, that training, at graphisoft.com/us/entrearchitect. That's our dedicated page on the Graphisoft website. Okay, so that's step two. Step two, I gained the training package. Step three, I started. Yes, after all these decades, I finally started learning how to BIM. I scheduled a block of time. This is how I'm doing it. I blocked out a time every Friday dedicated exclusively to learning to BIM. Everything else is going to be turned off every Friday for 3 hours in the afternoon, and I am going to make progress on learning this program. And truthfully, this is a very humbling experience. This is not, you know, start it up and start using it, right? This is I'm starting at the very beginning. I'm learning to draw lines and circles, right? This is frustrating for me. I just want to use it, right? But I know that if I start at the beginning, we will make progress, and eventually I'm going to be able to master this program as well. And I can tell you, as a 50-plus-year-old, it's pretty awesome to learn a new program, to learn something new. I haven't learned a new program or a new process like this in a long time. And so for me, it's exciting to learn from the beginning and knowing that eventually I'm going to master this. Like I've mastered so many other programs, this is a program that I'm going to master. So I'm really looking forward to this. But I could tell you, you have to start at the beginning, lines and circles. That's where I am. And I'll keep you posted as I progress with that. But that leads me to number four. This is the fourth thing I did today or this week. I set up a Facebook group dedicated to learning to BIM just for us, just for the rest of us and me who are learning to BIM. It's at facebook.com/groups/learningtobim, all one word. It's another Entree Architect group on Facebook. It's private, just like our main group. And just like our main group, it's a place of encouragement and support. And so if you're interested in joining a Facebook group about learning to BIM, it's for both beginners like me and maybe you, and pros who may be you. You may be a pro, you may be, and it's program agnostic, right? This is not an ArchiCAD group. This is a BIM group. So everybody's welcome. This is not a your software is better than my software place. In fact, there's a rule against that. We want you to share your experiences with all your software. This is about learning to BIM. This is not about learning ArchiCAD. This group is for all of us. So I encourage you to join it, whether you're a beginner or a pro or somewhere in between, and let's do this together. I'm looking forward to learning about your journey, and I'm going to share my journey there as well. facebook.com/groups/learningtobim. So that's my first update. I will periodically share all my progress here on the podcast at the very end, right? So listen to the end of every episode. I'm going to add these updates at the very end as bonus content, just like I did with this episode, after the regular episode is finished. After the love, learn, share, all of that done, then I'm going to give you an update. So don't miss them. And it's not going to be every week. So it's going to be periodically. So listen to the end of every episode to see what my next update is. And I'd love to connect with you directly. Again, facebook.com/groups/learningtobim. share your thoughts. I want to know what you think about my progress and what's happening here. If you're thinking about finally making that transition from CAD to BIM, I encourage you to reach out to our friends at Graphisoft. Check out that website, graphisoft.com/US/EntreArchitect. It's not just a great software. They're great people. There's some free video content there, information about the Essentials package, information about how to purchase ArchiCAD if you're interested. Go there, graphisoft.com/US/EntreArchitect. That's important, graphisoft.com/US/EntreArchitect. And you could see how Graphisoft is positioned to help us architecture firms succeed. So that's it. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you at the next update as I continue learning to BIM. Have a great day.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entre Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entre Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.